Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Leo Varadkar, good morning.
Morning.
You are, of course, a former Taoiseach, and now you've written a memoir, Speaking My Mind. It's a great read. It gives us lots of insights into our recent history, but also fascinating insights into you and what makes you tick. So will we start with you? You were an unusual child, were you? Eccentric is the word you use?
Yeah, I guess so. I'm not sure I knew I was unusual at the time, although I probably did. So I guess when other kids were interested in sport and football and everything else, I was interested in politics and interested in elections. And I start the book with a story of me going down to vote with my mum. I think it was the 1987 election, and how fascinated I was at the voting process. You know, posters going up on lampposts, people who were relatively ordinary people being transformed into leaders through the power of democracy. So I don't know where it came from, but my interest in politics really goes back to those very early years when I was really only 7 or 8 years old.
Okay. And you grow into a teenager then. You kind of admit you might have been a bit of a pompous teenager, very interested in politics, not into sport, as you say. You say you spent more time on your own than most teenagers. You say it took you time to feel confident around people. Are you shy?
Yes. I prefer the term reserved. You've probably heard the joke about the two Englishmen on the desert island who never got to speak because they're waiting for someone to introduce them.
Yeah.
And I'm probably a bit like that. And sometimes people, I think, interpret it maybe as being a bit cold. But I don't think I'm cold at all. I think I'm actually a pretty warm person once you get to know me. But I am a bit shy. I'm a bit reserved. One of my best friends, Stephen, says it took me about 10 years to warm up to people. Yeah. And I have got better, but I've had to train myself to be better at, you know, sticking out the hand first, introducing myself, you know,
almost
being more friendly. Yeah, in a way that I think for other people, you know, like my predecessor, Enda Kenny, would be just natural. You know, for me, I had to kind of learn that. And I did get better at it down the years. But, you know, when something doesn't come natural, it doesn't come natural. I'm much more comfortable debating in a studio or making a speech than I would be working a room.
Okay. So when there are clear rules and it's a situation. Yeah, you say almost as a throwaway, you say, as someone who grew up in a family where feelings were kept private. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, look, I'm close to my family. They're all at the launch the other night, and took them for dinner afterwards. My sister lives in London. I'll be seeing her at the launch event in London next week. So
was it a repressed?
No, just not a touchy feely family. So I don't know how many Irish families actually are that touchy feely, to be honest. But you know, don't hug each other. You know,
but feelings were private.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Like not entirely private, but more private, you know, so.
How did that affect you, do you think, internalising that?
I think it just is part of the reason why I am quite reserved, and I don't necessarily feel the need to tell people that I'm happy or angry or sad or whatever. And there's pluses and minuses that, you know, when you're working as a doctor, and that was the job I did for 7 years, you know, I had to deal with a patient that was dying in front of me, had to speak to their family, and then 10 minutes later look at somebody's sore throat and treat them as if they were just the same, you know. So there are advantages to these things, but there are disadvantages too. And I know one of the criticisms of me as a politician was that I often lacked empathy, and I don't think I lack empathy, but I think I'm not good at performative empathy. I wasn't any good at those big moments, you know, where you needed to, on occasion I was, but most of the time I wasn't, you know, where you needed to reflect the mood of the nation.
Yeah, because that's an important part of leadership.
It took me a long time to learn that. You know, I used to feel that it was a bit fake, but it's actually not. You know, performative empathy is important. That's an important part of communications. And
interesting.
It took me a while to. I was well into my first term of Taoiseach before I really understood that it wasn't actually contrived. That it was, you know, sometimes you actually need to show you care.
And that
in a very
is authentic
way, or people will people might think you don't, you know.
As people will know, your dad Ashok is Indian, and you say you're sorry now you weren't more connected to your Indian background when you were young. You say that fitting in was very important to your parents. I thought that was interesting. Is that a defense mechanism of immigrants like your dad, that you must fit in because you're different?
Well, I think I grew up in a very different Ireland. You know, I grew up in Dublin 15, Bantustan, Castleknock area, which is now one of the most diverse parts of Ireland. But like when I went to school, I was the only brown kid with a funny surname. And I remember meeting Barack Obama in DC once, and we had the same conversation because he was raised in Kansas by his grandparents, and he was the tall, dark kid with the funny name too. And yeah, so definitely kind of wanted to fit in.
Keep your head down.
Didn't want to be treated any differently. And you are, you know, just by virtue of the fact that you have a foreign surname, that you're a person of colour, you know, people would make assumptions about you that they wouldn't about other people. It's unconscious bias that people are often very unaware of, certainly the majority.
So you are trying to kind of super assimilate all the time then?
I think so. I don't bother at all now. But I think partially being
that's exhausting for a kid, isn't it?
Well, look, partially being biracial and also being gay too. You know, I was very keen in my early years through adolescence, certainly into early adulthood, to be very normal and to just fit in and maybe be quite standard and also maybe be quite conservative. And that changed for me for lots of different reasons.
And we might come to that. So yeah, you were very ambitious, weren't
yes.
you? And you wanted to be Taoiseach from the age of what?
Look, I'm not sure when I wanted to be Taoiseach, but I definitely wanted to run for election. And I hoped that would take me as far as it might. You know, whether that was the European Parliament or Cabinet or Taoiseach, I don't know. I didn't particularly fix on that. But I definitely wanted to be elected, and once elected, then go as far as I could go.
As a child, why does a child want that?
I'm not sure as a child, but certainly as a teenager and a young adult, I did want to change the world. Like, I do genuinely care about my country, my community, my planet. And I was never the kind of person who could just give out about the way things are and say all those people who are up there are rubbish.
Okay.
You know, I'm not cynical. And I genuinely feel that if you see a problem, you should try and get stuck in and try and solve it. So, you know, grew up in West Dublin, rapidly developing area, huge numbers of new houses being built during the boom period. As I say in the book, more golf courses than playgrounds. Proud that I managed to be part of a group that changed that. You know, very, very limited schools, facilities, all those things, you know, wanted to change that, not just complain about it.
Okay.
And then the same thing for the state of the country. And you know, I'm glad I was able to change some things for the better. In other areas, I was not able to make things better.
Yeah.
But at least I tried, you know.
Yeah.
And I think if I hadn't gotten to politics, I'd probably be one of those angry people on Twitter giving out all the time or, you know,
yeah,
something like that.
And this time, yeah.
Kind of got that out of my system, you know.
So that ambition then, when you got into politics, you say as a young frontbencher, you were cocky, you let it show, people found you arrogant, insensitive, but you're glad that's who you were at 28. Why?
If I could go back and do it all over again, I would have moderated and modulated that for sure. But, you know, I am who I was, so,
yeah.
You know,
but
you did
say in the book you're glad that's who you were. Was that necessary at that stage of your career? Make a splash?
I think when you're a first-time TD and you're ambitious, you want to get noticed and you want to make a difference. And, you know, certainly the Fine Gael party at the time was very happy that they had somebody like me who was willing to go into studio and, you know, take people on in debates and maybe not be as civil and polite as the party traditionally might have been. So,
do you regret that? No,
I don't regret it, but there's definitely a few things that I do regret. I don't regret it in the round, but there's a few moments when I went too far and
yeah,
and I'm you kind of ashamed of them, but
the
I can't take that back. Yeah,
moment,
yeah, that's one of them.
Yeah. You also say you were kind of puritanical and judgmental at that stage of your life. You think that being closeted, which I think is the word you use, about your sexuality, made you more so puritanical and judgmental. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so I think there's two things. I think definitely when you're younger, you know, you can be more idealistic and you tend to see things more black and white. Mm. And I think for all of us, life experience teaches you that things aren't so black and white. there's a big grey mush in the middle, which is where the real world lives and where decisions are really made. And that just comes, I think, with growing up. There is an added dimension for me in that I was a gay man. I knew I was. I didn't want to admit it to myself. That's the hardest part, I think, is to come out to yourself before you come out to anyone else. And that, I think, allowed me to be more judgmental of other people. You know, that if I could repress who I was, you know, why couldn't they be more disciplined, you know? And wow. That's just not the way I think anymore, but it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've always been an economic liberal on the centre-right economically. I did move from being very socially conservative to being socially liberal, and I know some people think that was fake, you know, that I was just following the opinion polls or whatever. But people who know me and know my story know that's not true. It has a lot more to do with my own life experience.
Tell me about coming out to yourself, because you do say you knew you were gay when you were young. You thought that was a phase.
Mm.
I'm interested in how you tell that to yourself. And then as you grow up, you're still in denial about in a way, the core of who you are. Yeah.
Yeah. See, I didn't think it was the core of who I was, you know. I remember, you know, when I did that interview here in RT with Miriam McCallan, where I told the nation that I was gay. I remember saying things that I can't believe I said now. You know, one was that, you know, it's just part of who I am. It's just another thing. It's not part of my identity. Like, I can't believe I said that, you know, because of course it is. It's so much part of who I am. It has to be. And then another thing I said as well, was that, you know, I had forgotten this, that I actually thought through my 20s and into my 30s that I would always be alone, that I'd never find a partner.
Yeah.
And I was willing to give 100% to my career and politics in the country as a result of that. And that obviously fundamentally changed very quickly. One thing I said as well, which I'm kind of glad I said, and I kind of said, you know, I hope that for the next generation of people coming behind me who are gay or lesbian or bisexual, that they don't have to come out in this way. And I remember when, you know, Jack Chambers, my existing colleague, somebody who I know very well and like very much, came out, it was such a non-event. Yeah. And I was so glad that that was the case, you know.
Yeah, and you do say in the book that it took you years to listen back to that Miriam interview, and you found it very devastatingly sad when you did. So go back to then. I won't push on this again, but I'm just interested, like, on the toll it takes, or how you do it for all those years of denying to yourself who you are. What does that look like inside?
But see, it wasn't. You know, I wasn't in torment and torture or anything like that. I wasn't, you know, so. There's a really, really, really good book. It's called The Velvet Rage, and a friend of mine gave it to me. And it, in some ways, explains the psychology of a lot of closeted gay men. And one of the things that we do is when we're not able to come out to ourselves, we throw ourselves into something else. You know, and it could be your career, it could be your work, it could be your art, it could be your music. And you see this, you know, with a lot of high-performing gay men, lesbians, that's exactly what they do. They totally throw themselves into some other enterprise.
And do you know you're not coming out to yourself, or do you not even
know
that?
You don't know any of this at the time. Okay. Or maybe you do at some level, but I didn't really. And it's kind of only after the fact.
So you knew you were gay, but you kind of didn't really?
I know I did. Yeah, no,
yeah.
Of course I did.
Yeah,
but I thought it was going to go away, or I thought I might meet this wonderful woman who would change everything for me, and that never happened.
People will remember you wrote a letter to Kylie Minogue on government note paper. You don't talk about a lot of incidents of homophobia in the book, but you wrote a letter to her asking to meet her when she was in Ireland. You do feel there was an undercurrent of homophobia around the reaction to that?
Yeah, look, I'm not saying there was, but I am saying that's how I felt. And that's not necessarily the same thing. And, you know, homophobia is a wide spectrum. You know, it ranges from, you know, being attacked or killed for being gay, and that still happens in our country. It ranges, you know, to being discriminated against in the workplace. And it's also the unconscious bias. You know, people don't know they're doing it, but they treat you differently without realising it. And I think it was probably in that space. But more importantly, it's not really what I think matters. It's how I felt at the time, and I couldn't say it at the time because I made a decision very deliberately that I wouldn't complain about, you know, perceived racism or homophobia.
Why?
Where I felt it occurred. Because it can be disputed. You know, you can't necessarily always prove it unless it's absolutely blatant. And then secondly, I didn't want people to think that I was engaging in any form of self-pity, because I don't think people want that from politicians. They want you to be focused on the things they care about, not on what you care about or how you're feeling that day.
Okay.
And I was okay with that. But the great thing about being able to write a book now is what's in it, and what I can do in the book is say the stuff I couldn't say, say what I was thinking, say what I was feeling, the stuff you can't find on the Irish Times website or on Google or any other source.
Yeah. To wit, for example, COVID, right, which defined a few years of your career and of all our lives, really. And clearly, look, we all knew there were tensions at the time within government, between government and NPHET, all of that. But I do feel you're able to say some of the things now that you maybe, you maybe spilt out a bit at the time. But so you call Tony Holohan arrogant and inflexible. You say he established NPHET without government decision or ministerial sanction. Are you saying it was a power grab?
No, and what I also say in the book is that he was a brilliant public servant, somebody who I worked with on lots of things, you know, on public health, alcohol legislation, which is,
take all that as given.
I don't want to the only thing I think about Tony Holohan is that he's an arrogant man. He's actually a brilliant public servant who's made a huge contribution to our society.
The setting up of NPHET, the government had nothing to do with it, and it's just happened.
Yeah.
You were told then, yeah?
It was already in existence and operating, certainly before the government knew about it, and it was never, you know, most kind of bodies or committees are set up with some form of ministerial sanction or memo.
That wasn't the case. Considering how powerful it got, this seems bizarre, doesn't it?
Yeah, and we let it become powerful. In my view, we let it become too powerful.
You were running the country.
Yeah.
So how did you let that happen?
Well, look, it was a pandemic. It was a pandemic the like of which we hadn't seen for 100 years. There was no manual. I think it was Paul Reid, you know, the head of the HSE, said at the time, and he was absolutely right, we'd probably get about 70% of decisions right. When you compare Ireland's performance, you know, in terms of lives saved, in terms of the economic damage, we perform objectively in any study really well. So I think we did a good job managing COVID.
Yeah, by having long lockdowns by the metrics applied internationally. How did you let NPHET get too powerful without you, who are running the country, wanting them to be that powerful? How did you let that happen?
I think in the first phase of the pandemic, it wasn't a problem because we were all aligned and we all agreed that we were dealing with an unprecedented event. We needed to take action. You know, we locked down the country long before other countries did, you know, US, UK, Brazil being examples that took too long. And I think we made the right decisions where it became. So, you know, it didn't matter then because we were largely all agreed and all on the same side. I think where it became more of an issue was later on, you know, was 6 months, 8 months, 9 months into the pandemic where certainly my views and the views of some other cabinet members, but not all, were starting to diverge from the advice that NPHET was giving us.
Afraid of them at that point? Or you were running the country, not to be repetitive, why didn't you take the power back from them?
We could have done, and we did discuss that. And bear in mind, at this stage, it was a coalition government involving three parties. And we did discuss that. Invariably, the decision that was made was to keep it in existence for a longer period.
Not by you.
I certainly would have liked it to have been dissolved earlier and replaced with a different body, a body that would have had expertise from other areas. You know, for example, people who'd have a particular interest in education and children's health wider view, which is what was done in some other countries.
Yeah. Like you do use the words that we got a bit authoritarian around COVID. For example, you don't believe schools should have been closed to the extent they were.
I think
why didn't you get them opened?
I think the schools were closed for too long. I think it was right to close them down, by the way.
Why didn't you get them opened?
Because coalition government, so three parties, you would need all three parties to agree. And I think it's fair to say, I say this in the book, that Micheál would have been more cautious than I would have been, or Eamon would have been, on these matters. But in a coalition government, decisions are made at the pace of the last person in many ways. So, you know, that was a factor. And then there was also the public health advice. And bear in mind, we went against the public health advice quite dramatically in October of the first year of the pandemic. And, and got that wrong. Yeah. Well, this was even before the meaningful
Christmas. Yeah.
So on the one occasion that we, on the first occasion that we did go against the advice of NPHET, we probably got it wrong. And that made us a bit afraid.
You were a bit afraid.
And I kind of recount that in the book, you know, where I'm having this conversation with Pascal Donoghue and he's, you know, broadly in agreement with me. But what he says back to me, and he's right, is that we've gone against NPHET advice once. We got that wrong. We can only afford to do that again once. So we'd want to make sure we're really sure. But, you know,
I think people listening will be saying, though, like, there's... You would agree, I think. Mike Ryan has been saying similar during the week. There's a young generation terribly scarred by this, right? People are probably thinking now, the pain they had of the cocooning was another one that really hurt older people, I think. People dying alone, no proper funerals. Was all of that necessary?
Some of it definitely was. And again, you know, this was an unprecedented event. The first pandemic of this nature in 100 years, there was no way we were going to get all of the decisions right. And you can only make decisions based on the information available to you. But don't forget the context of the time. You know, remember what people, where public opinion was. Public opinion was actually for stronger, stricter lockdowns. And we polled this regularly to see what the public were thinking. The opposition parties were calling for zero COVID or something even approaching that. They wanted the Chinese approach or the New Zealand approach. You know, so we had to take all that into account as well.
Okay.
But one thing I was always aware of was, you know, it wasn't a choice between yes, lockdown and let's save lives and no, ease the restrictions and more people will die, but so what? That was never the choice. The choice was between A, B or C, and there are pros and cons. And I knew that by having restrictions in place, we would save lives and reduce morbidity and illness. I also knew at the same time that it would do harms.
That it would do harms,
some of which we're now experiencing. And it was very hard to articulate that at the time.
Going back to your broader career, what are your biggest regrets?
Lack of optimism or inadequate optimism on one particular matter.
Yeah.
The extent to which our economy would bounce back so quickly, so many times. You know, so I was there for, you know, the bailout, picking up the pieces after the crash, ending austerity back around 2014. I was there for Brexit and I was there for COVID. And on three occasions, the economy bounced back way quicker than we thought it would. Had we known that it was going to bounce back as quickly as it did, we would have ramped up capital investment quicker. So investment in things like housing, like transport, you know, new schools, new buildings, infrastructure. And I think some of the problems that we have now would be less worse had we known what we did now. But hindsight's 2020.
It is. But like you did, you would say you did fail abysmally on housing, and it has become like it is almost the catastrophe that's at the root of so many of the other problems in this country now, isn't it?
I think it's the worst and the most serious and most acute problem that we face as a country. You know, the country
got a lot worse
well
in your time, didn't it?
It got worse, yeah. I'm not denying that. We did not succeed in fixing the housing crisis, and that's an understatement. In our defence, and I hope you'll allow me to do this, there are a few things that we did that I think shouldn't be missed. You know, when I got into government, there were about 7,000 houses a year being built. It's now over 30,000, so we quadrupled the number of new homes being built. We set up a state developer in the LDA. Social housing is now being built at a pace we haven't seen since the 1970s. And the number of first-time buyers now, it's 500-600 a week. That's the highest since the Celtic Tiger period.
Okay.
Was it adequate? Was it adequate? Nowhere near.
Yeah, I could quote all the staff.
Yeah,
you accept too little,
yeah,
too late.
But I think the problem, I think some people will craft it as a failure of policy and a failure of ideology. I disagree with that. I think it's more a mathematical problem. There are 5.6 million people in Ireland now, roughly. You need about 2.6 million houses for them. We're 400,000 short. And I don't know, you know, there's lots of people who give you great advice on housing and great ideology and tell you they care more about it and all the rest of it. You know, who's actually producing the 10 or 20 pager that's showing me how we can build 400,000 houses in 5 years?
OK, but you will accept, I know, that there weren't houses built for a lot of time. And you're saying that a lot of that is to do with
I think you made
the mistake of being too cautious.
I think we could have done better.
OK.
Had we made some of the decisions that we made earlier.
Was being Taoiseach everything you hoped?
I can't even remember what I hoped. it was 2017 and it seems like a lifetime ago. I know it was great and I loved it and it was a real privilege and I enjoyed it and it was great to be able to make a difference. But I also knew the point at which I didn't enjoy it anymore.
Is it fair to say that there were kind of a number of events, things that happened that made you, and I think as well Matt, your partner, and we know that people's families, partners are very important in these situations, get more disenchanted with public life. So you remember back to the COVID, people were annoyed when you went to the Mighty Hoopla Festival in London. This was at a time
when
the electric...
Which I should not have done.
Yeah, and this was at a time when the electric picnic had been cancelled.
Yeah, but it was also a time when we were lifting the restriction on major events 2 days later. And in my head, I thought, you know, 2 days doesn't make a difference. But it did, actually.
Yeah, because you forgot who you were in that, the optics of that. You said that's when you first thought, I don't want to do this anymore. I want to live my life my way. I'm a different person now. My priorities have changed. So was that a big turning point for you, yeah?
There was no exact moment or turning point, to be very frank.
But that is when you first thought that.
It's when I first remember thinking it. I think it was coming. You know, one of the things that I experienced during the pandemic, I think like a lot of people, but more so given the job that I had, was being at home in the evenings. You know, I was a politician from the age of 23, 24. Before that, I was a junior doctor. You know, for probably the first time since I was a kid, I was actually at home in the evenings. I was at home at weekends. You know, one thing I'm really experiencing now and really loving about life is, you know, four or five nights a week, I cook my own dinner. You know, I actually control what I eat in the evenings.
So you don't need to batch cook and fill the fridge.
well, it's Matt who does that, actually. But you know, just kind of little normal things in life that you forget are possible. You know, went to the gym yesterday morning, put on my baseball cap, walked down the South Circular Road, no guards behind me, nobody recognised me. You know, like just having a normal life is something I forgot. I didn't know what it could be like.
Yeah. And tell me then about the night in the Lost Lane nightclub that got, in your words, out of hand. This is the infamous kiss video.
Well, it's all in the book.
No, come on.
Look, I felt I should write about it because if I didn't, it would be an omission that people would rightly point out. And look, it's there. Yeah, it's in the book for people to read. I'm little uncomfortable talking about it because obviously it is embarrassing and it does involve other people too.
Okay.
But one thing I would say...
Was that another moment?
No, not really actually because, you know, I was about to become Taoiseach again in a few weeks' time. And in my mind at that point, I was thinking, you know, chance to become Taoiseach again for a second time, you know, going to give it everything. Going to try and do a better job than I did the first time. So, that was my mindset at that time.
Okay. Was there a sense when you did become Taoiseach the second time? I think a lot of people were feeling at the time, is he a bit not as energised or enthused about it this time, a bit more jaded? Was there a sense of that in your second stint?
Definitely not jaded, because I wasn't. You know, I was very determined to make the most of it and to do a good job. And my intention in going into it was to be a good Taoiseach, have a good second term, lead my party into the election, hopefully gain some seats, you know, and come back with a better result than we had in 2020, which was a huge disappointment for me, obviously, given the result. So not at that time. I did decide on a different approach, which was, you know, a more low-key approach. When I was Taoiseach the first time, I was doing everything for the first time. You know, I wanted to be very much out there. you know, put on a good show, be talking to the media all the time, be launching initiatives all the time. I decided the second term deliberately would be different, that it would be a little bit more low key, a little bit more focused on
the
job.
Was that to do it as well, that Matt was, I think, ambivalent about you becoming Taoiseach again? Was he having enough at this stage of not having a private life?
No, it was much more a political calculation. It was my second term. I'd already been leader of my party for 5 or 6 years. I certainly felt that people wanted something different. You know, I'd kind of done the new thing already, and we were halfway into a government and halfway into a programme for government. So I felt the important thing was continuity and to continue on from the work that Micheál had been doing before me, rather than, you know, a big relaunch.
Okay. So why did you quit then when you did?
Yeah, well, different sets of reasons. The personal reasons were that I wasn't loving the job anymore. And it's a job that is all consuming. You're never really off. Weekends, holidays, you name it. You know, you're always working. And I didn't like that anymore, quite frankly. And then I felt, in terms of the politics, that I probably had passed my peak in terms of what I could achieve. You've so much political capital, something Enda Kenny said to me. You start off in office with the whole bank of political capital. And as time goes by and as you make unpopular decisions, that's depleted. And you can replenish it, but it's very hard to do. And I kind of felt that that had become depleted to the point whereby a new leader would be able to do new things that I couldn't do, and would be able to get a better result in the forthcoming local elections and European elections and general election. And that was actually important to me because, you know, a lot of people who are running in those elections, you know, they weren't just party members, they're personal friends, and I wanted to see them re-elected.
Okay. Your successor, Simon Harris, is rightfully angry right now about the price his family is paying for his political career. Did you get threats? Did you get abuse? Hard to take?
Yeah. Well, loads. So we had the bomb threats at the house. We had the protests outside the house. Various death threats of varying degrees of credibility. I always asked my staff and the Gardaí not to tell me about it. Didn't want to know about it. Unless there's a particular reason that I should know, or that, you know, something I should be looking out for, because I didn't want it to affect my performance or affect my mindset. I remember one time, it was the 2020 election, and in the boot of the car, and it was a Garda car, there was this two big bags of fluid, and it was water and some sort of base fluid. And the reason why I was there was because somebody had threatened to throw acid on me if I was out canvassing in my constituency.
Did you know that?
I didn't. And the only reason why I knew is because when I saw the bags of fluid in the boot of the car, I said, you know, to the guards, what's all that about? So, you know, I had this policy of don't tell me, because I didn't want to know. And then I also took the view that I didn't want to talk about it too much in public, because I didn't want to give those people the satisfaction of thinking that they'd affected me or bothered me in any way. I think what Simon is doing is right now that he's speaking out against it. I also think it's different for him. You know, he's a wife and kids. The nature of the threats to his wife in particular and to his kids are different than they would have been to me. And I'm actually glad that he's speaking out against it.
So do you miss it then when you're gone suddenly? You're suddenly not the most important person in the room anymore?
Not a bit.
No?
No. I thought I would. I was, you know, because I thought about it for a few months. As I say in the book, I'd originally planned to step down first thing in the new year, but events intervened, which didn't allow me to do that. And I had prepared myself. You know, I thought, you know, 20% regret. So, you know, I remember thinking when it came to, just to give you one example, the recognition of Palestine, you know, something that I'd been working on for a few months. The conversation started in the Elysee Palace with the Prime Minister of Palestine, thanked us for the work we were doing in Ireland. I asked, what more can we do? He said, can you get the recognition thing going again? And, you know, had meetings then to get other countries on board, Slovenia, Spain and so on. And I remember seeing the announcement on the steps of government buildings, and the announcement was being made by Micheál and Simon and Eamon, who'd followed through in the work and got it done and got Norway on board and others. And I thought to myself, I should be feeling that I should be there. And I wasn't. I was perfectly happy not to be there and to be getting on my life, which I am.
So obviously you're supporting Heather Humphreys for presidency. Catherine Connolly and Jim Gavin are the other confirmed candidates. You know, J- Jim Gavin well, do you?
Yeah, well, I know Heather extremely well, of course, yeah. And I am giving her my number one vote, and I think she'd be a great president if she's elected. I know Jim too, yeah, because I was Minister for Transport when he was a senior staff member in the Irish Aviation Authority. I know him from GA. I appointed him to chair a Citizens Assembly on the Government of Dublin and know him through the North East Inner City Task Force. I actually thought he was one of us as well. I'm one of those okay. who thought he was a Fine Gael supporter. Maybe he goes between the two parties. That's not that unusual these days and not a bad thing. So, you know, he's a very accomplished person. Anything I've ever seen him do, he's done brilliantly. So wouldn't have a bad word to say about him.
Okay.
One thing I would say, though, and I say it in the book, and bear in mind, I wrote this when I thought Mairead McGuinness was going to be the Fine Gael candidate. And I say that one of the things I really appreciated as Taoiseach about Michael Dee, about our president, President Higgins, was that he had been a member of Parliament, been a member of the Dáil, that he'd been a government minister, that he understood the job of the government and the Taoiseach. He didn't just have a technical understanding of the Constitution. He had a practical understanding okay. of the Constitution, and actually Heather Humphreys is the only person nominated so far.
Well, let's not get into that now because, all candidates have their own.
Sure. And you know, for example,
you got on okay with Donald Trump, did you?
Was a great president. Yeah, I did. Yeah. Like he's a very personable, gregarious, funny person and a big personality. So yeah, I did.
You're watching,
that doesn't mean I agree with politics. It's different thing entirely.
Yeah, okay. You're watching what's going on in America now, where I think febrile would be one word for it. You were saying there that Spencer Cox, the governor of Utah, who I think a lot of people noted, he spoke very well yesterday, talked about this being a watershed and talked about the need for people to come together now, even though he is a Republican. A lot of other Republicans aren't towing that line. You know him? And
I do, yeah. I met him. We spoke together at the Gridiron Dinner in Washington, D.C., March 2 years ago. We had a good chat. He's a Republican governor in a very red state, a very conservative state, which is the state of Utah. He's a Mormon, a very religious person. And part of what he is trying to do is teach America to disagree better. He says Americans need to learn to disagree better. Even though he's a Republican governor, he vetoes anti-LGBT legislation, for example, in Utah. And I thought some of the words that he said were very compelling. One thing he said is the only person to blame for the murder of Charlie Kirk is the person who committed the murder. You know, there are so many other people now who will try to use this to make political points, whether it's about gun control or whether it's about, you know, the liberal left being violent, which is not the case. He made it very clear that the only person who's responsible for this is the person who committed this awful crime. Widowed a wife and orphan kids.
And you have spent a bit of time in America recently. I think
the other thing you said as well, which I think was important too, and I think some people misinterpreted. You know, he said that he was really, really sad and really sorry that the person who carried out this act was one of us. And some people have misinterpreted that to say, oh, he was hoping it was a migrant or something. That's not what he's saying at all. He's pointing out that the person who carried out this terrible murder, you know, is a young white man from Utah. You know, a little bit like, remind me of RFK's speech about Martin Luther King being killed. And he talked about how, you know, how my brother was also killed by a white man. And there are so many people now in America who will try to exploit this terrible, tragic event, which has left two kids without a father, for their own political means. And at least there's somebody in the form of Governor Cox who is taking a different line. And the kind of line that I think we should see from our political leaders is that when a terrible event like this happens, tries to bring people together and doesn't look to blame people or look for retribution.
Okay. Speaking My Mind is out now. It's published by Sandy Cove and Leo. You'll be in conversation with Gavin Riley as part of the Boris Festival, but that's in Dublin on September 14th.
That's right, Mansion House tomorrow night.
Okay. Tomorrow night. Yeah, sorry. And tickets for that are available at festivalofwritingandideas.com. Leo Varadkar, thank you very much.
Thank you.